you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome back to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast safe to listen to even if you haven't washed your hands, but also wash your hands. It's March 26th, 2020, and we're still in social isolation. Jason and I are both still playing Persona 5 Royal, and Kirk and I are both playing Animal Crossing New Horizons. Kirk is also playing 6 billion other games, from Doom Eternal to Half-Life Alyx. We read a bunch of listener emails about coping with COVID-19, including messages from healthcare workers and grocery store workers who have their own stresses in this time, and close it off with some off-topic talk about The Wire. Let's get to it! Back for another episode of Kotaku Split Screen. I'm Maddie Myers, and I'm joined by Kirk Hamilton. What's up, Kirk?
What's up, Maddie? It's nice to see you.
It's nice to see you, and it's also nice to see Jason Schreier. Hi, Jason.
Hello, 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 hello. Hello from beautiful quarantined New York City.
Beautiful, super relaxing New York.
We have a lot to get to today. Thank you to everybody who sent in your coronavirus coping strategies and stories. We have a lot of interesting listeners, of all stripes, of all types of careers.
It's really true.
It has been really fascinating to read all of your stories.
All fascinating. And clearly all very good looking people too. Very just smart, thoughtful.
Very talented, smart, charming,
wonderful, beautiful, handsome people. Kirk, before we get into some video game chat, you had one thing you wanted to mention?
I have an important correction to make from last week's discussion of the PlayStation 5. I mentioned off the top of my head when we were talking about resolution differences that Battlefield 4 on the PlayStation 4 ran at 1080p and on the Xbox One it ran at 900p. However, that is inaccurate. And I even thought at the time, because since I wrote an article about this, I vaguely remember this.
I can't believe this.
So, now, games like Assassin's Creed 4 Black Flag, now that ran at 1080p on the PS4 and 900p on the Xbox One, as I said Battlefield 4 did. However, Battlefield 4 ran at 900p on the PS4 and 720p on the Xbox One, which was particularly a particular bummer for the Xbox One because that was the resolution of the previous generation. And now that I've said that, I'm hoping that it's right because anytime I say a specific fact, I might be wrong and then be corrected by somebody.
Every single week from now on, the show starts with Kirk correcting his previous misstatement.
Just all about resolutions.
About this piece of information.
Right, from 7 years ago.
When I said that it was 75% of the frames ran at 60 frames per second and 4K resolution.
I meant 72.5% is actually what it was. Man.
What a world.
So I will say, though, accuracy matters. And I saw, Jason, you had transcribed that conversation over at Reset Era. And I did have the wrong numbers. I just should have said it ran at a slightly higher resolution on PS4. Teach me to be specific. I will be more vague from now on.
Right? No numbers, no actual game titles on this show from now on. We're never going to screw anything up.
We'll just say things.
The thing. Game. With the thing. It's it ran fine, at those, game. Those frames.
It's better than the other game.
It had frames in it. It had pixels. Who's to say how many?
Kirk, every week I'm going to quiz you on the number of teraflops in your GPU, and I expect full spec breakdowns of every single teraflop.
How many teraflops are in my GPU? I have a 2080. I wonder how many teraflops that is. I'm going to look it up.
I think that's something like 10. I think it's around 10.
I think it's 2,080 teraflops. I think that's it.
Whoa, Maddie's, this is Price is Right rules.
That would be a lot of teraflops. That would be quite a fast machine.
Yeah, it's just one teraflop if I were doing Price is Right rules.
Oh, man. How many teraflops do you have? I think I just bought it. I was at the grocery store this morning, and I think I bought a bag of baked teraflops, and they were fantastic.
Yum. Yeah, I'm glad those aren't sold out. Not yet, anyway.
There's a mad rush on teraflops. What is this show?
We're gonna leave all this in a stalling while Kirk Googles. Well, we have to stall, and Kirk has to like put in some music like he did last week while he Googles
Jeopardy theme.
His GPU
teraflops.
This is
kind of hard to answer this question. I've been Googling and like, okay, the RTX 2080, which is my card, is, let's see, teraflops. I feel like I should be, this is like a hard thing to answer.
Well, it doesn't really matter because there's so many other factors,
I guess,
with all this
maybe
stuff.
Maybe my not finding
it. I don't know what you're talking about. The only thing that matters is the number of teraflops, and that number needs to be higher than a previous number that I've seen. That's all I care about.
Like, somehow the marketing people have turned this into a weapon, and just like going back and forth between Sony and Microsoft over the past like 7 years of like, we have this number of teraflops. No, we have 4 teraflops. We have 6. We have 12. Xbox Series X.
So I'm looking at an article
teraflops.
On Tech Radar that says the 1080 is capable of 9 teraflops.
Wow.
And the 2080 is significantly faster than that. But probably not.
Is that all
crazy
it says?
Faster.
It just says it's significantly
faster.
It just says
the 1080.
Now, they have learned a lesson from you about vagueness by saying that, because who's to say how many teraflops it really is?
Bing. Kirk from the future here. As I edit this show, I just wanted to include the actual information. Via Tech Power Up, the number of teraflops in an RTX 2080 card is 10.07, so Jason pretty much had it right. Now back to the show, where Jason makes a very good point about why teraflops aren't actually that good of a metric. Bing!
Well, so even it's actually a good anyone. So not a lot of people, myself included, don't know the nitty gritty engineering details of how these machines work. But a lot of people have built a computer or at least have some familiarity with like the way a CPU and a GPU works. And even that's like a perfect example of why teraflops are such a like flawed measure of what these things can actually do. Because you play a game and you're like, oh, I have this hot new GPU, hot new graphics card in my system, but this game is still chugging at like 50 frames a second. And it could be because the game isn't optimized properly. It could be because you have bottlenecks on your CPU, or like
CPU
you don't have enough
locked.
RAM on your machine. Or there's so many other variables with all of this stuff that it's like the teraflops number really is just like. And I read a great article.
Yeah.
I'll put this article in the show notes about how like teraflops are just like this inadequate measure, and how really it's just like Sony and Microsoft's marketing teams over the past few years have like weaponized this number, and it's become this giant console war bait. And it's really, I mean, hilarious/frustrating to watch people just constantly talk about teraflops.
I'm glad that my bringing that up and bringing us and taking us down that rabbit hole has led to an actual thoughtful conclusion. Let's talk about video games now.
Yeah, let's do it.
Please.
So let's talk about some games that we are playing during our respective quarantines. I will go first because I don't have a ton to say, because I'm still playing a lot of Persona 5 Royal. I've been playing a shitload of this game. I just finished the third dungeon, Kanishiro's dungeon. That's Kanishiro. Well, I don't want to spoil for Maddie's because
still
she's still playing.
You don't want to spoil it for the listener either.
I won't like give the nature of it or anything like that, but it's the third one.
Is there a way you can give me a clue that isn't a spoiler? But
can you speak in code and describe?
It involves money. It's the one that involves money.
Okay. That's what I need to
say. You know what I'm talking about? Okay, cool.
If it were to make you think of an astrological sign, which sign would this dungeon remind you of? a set of tarot cards, perhaps. Go ahead, sorry.
It's very soothing, but also I forgot how stressful it is when you like are starting a new day and suddenly you have 10 different potential confidants who want to meet with you, and you have all these skills that you need to level up, and you can only do one thing at a time. Mandy, I don't know. I'll throw it to you in a second, because I don't know how far you've got, if you've gotten to the normal rhythm of the game yet, but essentially every single day you have to pick what you want to do, and you only get to do one thing during the day and then another thing at night. And you have to make smart decisions about like, who am I going to spend my time with? And first of all, it's hilarious to be doing this during quarantine when you can't actually make any real decisions about who you're going to spend
your time
with.
Yeah, it's nice though, right? You can like go out on the streets and talk to people and go
to a
restaurant.
It is nice. It's nice to live vicariously. It's a little anxiety inducing because every single like transition screen is just people crowded together. Or like there are all these scenes where you're on the Tokyo subway and it's like crowded people. So that's a little bit like, no, what are you guys doing?
Or you're in school and it's crowded. Yeah.
Also, people are wearing sick masks, because in Asian culture, like, people wear sick masks even way before any of this stuff, obviously. And in Japan, you would see people wearing sick masks. So like, you're walking around your high school in Tokyo and people just have these sick masks on.
And
it's like, oh my god. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I've been enjoying it quite a bit. Just a fantastic game. And the way that like all the different systems kind of interlock and interweave, and everything you do during the day will contribute in some way to what you are capable of doing during the dungeon, palace, memento sections, like the fighting sections. So it never really, it feels like everything you're doing is contributing to some sort of like long-term goal. It almost feels like Destiny in that way, like the way that any real good video game just like makes you feel like nothing you're doing is a waste of time. It's always contributing towards some larger goal. And in this, it's that like all of the social stuff you do during the day is contributing to what you are capable of doing when you go and fight stuff at night or during the day. So yeah, it's really cool. Maddie, what do you think? Because you have been, well, first of all, how far are you now?
I've only played a few more hours of it beyond where I was, because I mostly played Animal Crossing this week, which I'll talk about in a second. But I'm still interested in continuing Persona, and I will continue it. So I'm actually still in the first dungeon, and that might be because what I did immediately after unlocking that dungeon is like the next day in game day, I was like, I got this. I'm just going to go ahead and head on into that dungeon. And like they sort of railroad you into going to the airsoft store, getting some guns and various weapons there. And they give you an opportunity to meet this doctor who gives you some drugs. But I didn't really know what I needed to buy. So I just kind of like picked some stuff randomly. And then I was like dungeon crawling. And I think I'm almost at the end of this dungeon. I'm at like a room where there's a bunch of swinging axes. And like I'm killing some guys for the key. But so you know, I was playing for hours, you know, getting all the way to the end of this dungeon, but like I am out of stuff. Like I am so far out of stuff, and I super did not get the right items, and I have been like just dealing with item anxiety throughout the entire time. And then I finally realized that I was like, oh, I can just leave. Like I can literally leave the dungeon at any time and come back. And like that is how the game is supposed to work, but it kind of like hints that at you, but in a few ways, but it doesn't really spell it out. So I'm like I have barely any SP for anyone at this point, or like that's magic points basically is how this game works, and I've just been like rationing all my shit and like just nail biting my way through all of these fights, and then I'm like, why am I doing this? So I went back home, and I like put everybody to sleep, and I'm going to wake up, and the next time I play, I'm going to go get them a bunch of new weapons and items, because now I finally understand enough about how the system works, because I've been like fighting in dire conditions for long enough that I'm like, I'm really getting it and like understanding what kinds of shit I need. I guess like just as a tip, Jason, like when you play, do you largely just use the healing spells as opposed to healing items, or like, do you try to conserve your magic points when you play, or like that's the main quandary?
So
that
it depends. So I have the advantage of knowing a lot. Like I don't remember every detail, but I know a lot. So like I know, for example, in the second dungeon, there's a point at which the game says, okay, now you have to leave and you have to go and do this other thing, like the story related thing, before you can then come back into the dungeon and do it. And so the way that like to optimize Persona 5 is to do as much as possible in a single day when it comes to the dungeon, because otherwise you're wasting multiple days that you could be using like hanging out with your friends
and building social. I optimized the hell out of a day.
So the optimal way to do it would have been for you to get all the way to the end. And then, so the way it works is, as you will see, is once you get to the end, you don't actually fight a final boss. You have to leave and then come back. And I won't say why, but because you'll learn all that. But that's the rhythm of it. So the optimal way to play, the way to min-max it, is to do an entire dungeon, get to the end, then leave.
Wait and for so it to you're force just you using to leave, a single rather.
Thing. Exactly.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So yes. So that's how I've been playing on my second. I'm like this go around. But the first time I played, I wasn't that worried about it, because you get so many days over the course of the year that it doesn't really matter.
Right.
Like there's no harm in just being like, okay, like I'm out of my skill points or whatever they're called. I'm out of my SP.
I think you're right.
I'm just going to go home. So just be totally fine doing that. The game always gives you a ton of actual time before your deadline for each
palace.
And
there's a ton of safe rooms too, and you can go back into any safe room in the entire castle, which is like mega helpful. And once I understood that was the case, I was like, why was I doing this? Like, why was I making my life so much harder in this game? But, you know, who among us hasn't done that in a game that they're playing for the first time? Just making your life harder for no dang reason, because you don't really know what you're doing.
I think I did that in Persona 5 when I played it for the first time. And this is reminding me that I think I did the same thing you're describing, is because I didn't know I was reviewing it. There weren't even, like, no one had played it. Yeah. And I was, you know, like, oh, I guess I have to just keep going and going. And it got really dire. And I was like, this is so hard. And then when I finally left and understood what the game was, I was like, it was actually helpful. I remember that feeling of, oh, okay, now I know what to get at the store. I feel totally prepared for this. And then it was, basically fun.
I kind of like it as a choice because, like, you're playing as this totally unprepared teenager who's, like, flying by the seat of his pants in his life. And, like, I mean, the game starts with you getting lost in the subway station and it, like, forces you to be lost for a really long time. Like,
that's a great sequence.
Part of the game that you don't really know what you're doing, and the game really, the mechanics really allow you to feel that way. And, like, I don't know, it fits with the anxiety of being a teenager super well. And that is absolutely the theme of the game. Like, your powerlessness in the face of these systems you don't understand and adults screwing you over constantly. And, like, it all goes together really well. So I'm super enjoying that. I'm also, and Kirk, I see you're playing Animal Crossing as well. I guess
we're going to talk about this. We got to talk about Animal Crossing.
So I've never played Animal Crossing before. This first Animal Crossing game. But Kirk, I'm sure you're much more experienced. I guess I'll turn it over to you and you can tell me.
I played New Leaf. That was my first one, was the one before this. So, you know, I'm more experienced, but not wildly so. But no, I want to hear what you think of it. Go ahead.
All right. So I don't ever really play simulation games at all. Like, I don't really play The Sims or, like, games where you build stuff. Like, Minecraft is all right, but, like, I never got super into that. And so for me, I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to think of this kind of game. And I truly do not think I would be into Animal Crossing at all, except for the specific period of time that we are in as a society right now, which is that I cannot go anywhere or do anything other than see my girlfriend, whom I love very much, but that's it. That's the person I'm seeing. And in Animal Crossing, I can, like, go see my friends and I can also, like, socialize. And that's the whole point of the game. And I don't think it's like this in previous Animal Crossings where you can, like, go to other people's islands and stuff. Is that a new thing or is that always been a part
of
it?
You can do that. Okay, cool. Or you could do that in New Leaf and it was wonderful.
Yeah. So, like, in this game, you don't really do anything in Animal Crossing. You're an adorable little human on an island of adorable anthropomorphic animals, and you are under the thumb of a weirdly kind landlord named Tom Nook, who's a tanuki, like a raccoon dog. And you owe him so much money that it's absurd, but it doesn't really matter because time doesn't matter so much.
It's just an interest-free loan. Also, there's no interest.
Yeah, it's an interest-free loan. So, like, the activities you do are, like, fishing, hanging out, watching the waves go by, maybe you chop a tree, maybe you collect some stuff, but, like, ain't no rush really. And, like, there's all these, like, achievements that you can get within the game. So if you're, like, an achievement hound, it will definitely, like, set off those dopamine receptors for you, because it's like, catch a certain number of fish, you know, chop a certain number of trees, and, like, get these certain items, and then you, like, get ways to pay Tom Nook back. You're infinitely increasing balance, because every time you, like, build furniture for your little house or, like, do anything on the island at all, you, like, go further and further into debt, which, like, that's really funny in and of itself. But the point of the game is that you just chill out. It's supposed to be escapism. It's escapism, but, like, I don't know. I'm really enjoying the escapism part of it, but I also hate being in debt. So there is, like, this weird anxiety that I'm experiencing with it, where I'm like, this is like a debt practice simulator for me, where I just have to, like, accept that the whole purpose of this game is that I have to borrow things in order to eventually own them, as opposed to saving up money and then buying something.
It's, like, capitalism, the game.
I find sometimes that it's a little...
Well, that's home ownership.
It's calming to feel like I'm implementing a debt repayment plan in this game, which it's so easy to make bells. Like, you can just, like, pick fruit and sell them for a ton of bells, and that, you know, every day I pay 20,000 bells, like, toward my latest debt. And there's actually, even that is fairly calming, because there's no interest, there's no rush. You're not, like, losing money if you move slowly, or you don't need to lock in a fixed rate or anything like that. There's no market fluctuation.
And it's, like, this world where getting a job and, like, making money is so much easier than the real world, and, like, everyone's so nice to you. So, like, that part is escapism, because you're like, all the food is infinitely replenishing. Like, the environment will never be harmed by anything you do. Like, everything will come back, and you just look around your world and everything is yours for the taking. And, like, that, I guess, is a sort of capitalist fantasy of some kind. But, like, It's nice.
I saw someone say this on Twitter that the game, that video games in general, and this game certainly, they offer the fantasy of functional capitalism. It's basically right. like capitalism if it
or
worked
like a meritocracy.
Perfectly.
Yeah.
Right. yeah. Yeah. Like, and it was just totally fair, and it was still capitalism, but just there was no unfairness in the system. It's all
well. There are no billionaires. That's the key. Is that,
I think that like, maybe Tom Nook is a billionaire, but I'm not.
Well, that's what I said. By the way.
Oh, you said billionaires. Oh, I misheard you.
I said there are no billionaires.
I thought I was so clever.
Let's all say billionaire. Let's just make sure people know that that pun exists.
Jason made the pun first. It's a good pun.
Yep.
How can Tom Nook be a billionaire if he's out there handing out interest-free loans? That's what I want to know.
I'm not sure what motivates him.
Yeah, I don't know what motivates him either. I find it odd that he owns everything. Like, there's certainly like a disturbing undercurrent to this game that you try not to think too hard about, but it's odd to me.
There's a dystopian quality to it where it's very like, thank you for cooperating. They'll say, thank you for your cooperation. And I'm always like, I don't know. But I like that there's a slightly
That's like a communist fiction type thing. Like, thank you for
A little one, you're forming kind of this commune where you're all in debt to the company store that it has that I enjoy that part of
So you're saying that a cyberpunk game did in fact come out this spring. It just wasn't the one we were expecting.
There is, and you do get on the internet in this game and you do.
It's
a little cyber.
I just want to say quick side note. So Animal Crossing, it just came out, sold like 1.8 million copies in Japan. Right? In its first week, it set a whole new record. It beat Pokemon, it beat Smash, it beat everything in Japan. That's Japan alone, 1.8 million. That's like a number that anyone would kill for globally, and that's Japan alone. I think, I imagine that like when all is said and done, this will have sold like tens of millions of copies in this month
really
alone.
Want it right
well,
now.
So the question I was going to ask, the quick side note I was going to ask is, do you think there are people on Nintendo who are like secretly like feeling horribly guilty, but also amazing that this happened at the same time
as
Animal
Crossing? I'm sure it's like very bittersweet. I think probably a lot of game devs feel that way right now if their sales are doing really well.
Yeah, Doom Eternal also. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just probably feels really strange to be celebrating like big sales numbers, but knowing that it's because of a pandemic that's going to destroy so many other industries.
I'm sure that goes beyond video games. I think there are a lot of people who are seeing huge web orders for things and like making a lot of money via the internet in ways that they didn't before, and have to reconcile that with the fact that, you know, they're also maybe laying off employees, or they have, you know, like I think it's tough, but I guarantee there are people who feel very strange about how successful it is. And so to reflect on that success and then to talk about the game a little more, I can't believe this game came out right now. Like, it is so the game of the moment. I mean, my God. Like, I've been playing all of the games. I won't talk about all of them, but I'm playing a little bit of all the big new games.
Kirk's had a lot of time to play games. I don't know why.
They all came out and I was like, I'm going to just play through them all. And there's a lot of things I was excited to play. And Animal Crossing, just like I was like, I've been feeling really anxious this past week, just reading the news and everything.
Strange.
And feeling this constant sense of
can't
imagine why. something in the air, literally. And so I, you know, was playing whatever. I did play Ori and finish that. I'll talk about that in a second, just briefly. But then I'm playing all these like really violent games, Doom, Resident Evil.
Yep.
Playing Animal Crossing, I was like, holy shit, I feel like a physical feeling of relief playing this game. And I can tell everybody feels the same way. I mean, my Twitter feed is just nothing but people playing the game and sharing the game. I mean, it's that and then just like apocalyptic stuff and people in power doing horrible things.
And then
things
like another adorable Animal Crossing gif of like a bunch of people with nets spinning around in the game or something.
It's so wild to me that this game will forever be associated with this moment, and that there's a game that feels so calming to me and is so like a self-care kind of a game in a moment when we all desperately needed it, and then it just happened to come out. This was its planned release day. Like, it just happened to come out when this happened. It's incredible. So playing this game, I mean, God, I have a bunch of thoughts on it, but one thing, the main thing I want to talk about, I guess, is, so I played New Leaf. That was my first Animal Crossing. And
Is that on the 3DS? They're all like handheld games, right? Classically.
They have been, which I guess this one is too. It was on 3DS, and I got it, and I remember at the time being totally taken with the world and the energy and the way that it was so social. That was the thing I wasn't expecting. At the time, I was living in San Francisco. I was friends with some other people in video games, and I remember we were at, I was like at brunch with some people or something, which, remember going to brunch with people? Well, that was nice. I'm just going to live in that memory for a moment where we were all sitting around a table together. But I remember someone taking out their 3DS and being like, oh, let me show you this thing in Animal Crossing. And then soon everyone had their 3DSs out and I had never actually experienced something like that before. And it was people, it wasn't even like just other games journalists. It was all people at the table basically were like playing it, and it was so cool to share that. And then I was like going to other people's towns and having people visit, and it was just really nice. And I got into that, and then also just enjoyed the peculiar semi-sinister but also very happy vibe, the look of the game, the music, which is so wonderful. And more than anything, I love the way this game is based on real time, that it uses the clock in the game. I think that's like such a crucial part, at least for me, of the appeal of it. So Animal Crossing works on a real clock. This is for anyone who isn't playing it, of the five listeners who apparently aren't playing it.
Hey, I'm not playing it. I'm in the club.
That's true. So when you start the first game, the first day is just like not on a clock. But then when you, the second day begins, it tells you, okay, you are now locked into the clock. And then you tell it what hemisphere you're
in.
And
like if you sign in at 7 a.m., you see, you know, the sunlight of 7 a.m. outside, or like whatever. It looks like it's 7 a.m. inside the game too, and it tells you that. And that's
so the only deadlines that you have are like you want to finish something before midnight if you want it to go into effect the next day, because a lot of times it'll be like, we need you to get the materials to build a new store. So you get the materials and they're like, okay, cool, we're gonna tell us where you want to put it and we'll start building it and it'll be done tomorrow. So there's a lot of times in this game where you'll complete a task and then you just have to wait. And it isn't just wait until the next game day. You have to wait until tomorrow, until the actual tomorrow. So in between New Leaf and New Horizons, I played Stardew Valley. I loved Stardew Valley, became super addicted to it, played it again on Switch, got really into it. There's a lot, they're similar games. You go to the country in Stardew Valley, you start a farm, you know, build things, and it's all a sim, a life sim. But in Stardew Valley, there is no real time. It's instead days work on a schedule where you have a limited number of time and you just have to play through the day and like get as much done as you can. You have a stamina bar. You have to carefully manage. It's it is a little more like Persona, and it's much more stringent and hardcore. And if you're really going to play it, you wind up falling into this mindset of like extreme efficiency, where it's like, I'm going to like set up all of my crops so that I can just go quickly down and
like
water them.
Like a strategy
them, and then,
game.
Like it was literally like, I had it so my crops, I would run out of water in my water pail next to the lake. So I would fill up right there and then go up the next row. So you're super in this like squeezing every inch of productivity out of each day. And then each day just flows into the next day. So you can play Stardew Valley for like 6 hours and cover an entire season or two seasons worth of time in that game, just months of in-game time. That's not possible in Animal Crossing. So having played it in between New Leaf and this one, New Horizons, playing the new Animal Crossing, it's just been so striking to me how that one difference in the games that are otherwise somewhat similar makes such a big difference to me. And I love, at least right now, the real-time restriction. Like, I love that I'm forced to go slow. I know there's a whole discussion right now. I'm curious, actually, maybe, Maddie, I'm curious what you think of this. So I'll throw it to you on this in a second. But for me, it's been nice to go slow and to feel like I'm in no hurry. I just have to wait until tomorrow. I'm going to do some stuff and just wait and for the game to make me take my time and to never feel rushed. I have until tonight. It's just the middle of the afternoon. Have you seen that people are playing really hard? Because if you play hard, you can get super far.
Yes.
I know there's
and
some talk about
you
that.
You can mess with the dates. I mean, I have that some too. Friends who have that type of gaming anxiety, and I feel really grateful that I don't. Where if you started the game, there are people where the game unlocked for them at 9 p.m. the day before it came out for others. And I think there were like ways around that if you didn't live in Australia or whatever, wherever place it actually unlocked.
Right,
and so
right.
like some people started the game a day early and some people are like hard locked a day later in terms of what unlocks in the game. Even if you play every single day and do every single thing you're supposed to do, like there are some people who were a day behind. And then there are also just people like me where like I've played almost every day, but I missed a day and like now I'm just behind. And also I'm okay with it, but like I am behind in terms of what I'm going to be able to unlock. And that's kind of how the game works. And after you've played it for like 3 weeks, I think it ceases to matter. But in this weird time where so many people are playing Animal Crossing and they're playing it for so many more hours per day than the game is even designed for you to play, honestly, it's resulting in this bizarre situation where like people are catching like every fish and every creature before Blathers has even opened his museum for you to like give them to him. Yep. Or like they're just, you know, basically trying to spend all of their time in the game doing like an absurd amount of stuff, or like collecting as many resources as they can possibly collect and like grinding in order to get the travel tickets and go to other islands and like get more resources or whatever. Yep. Like beyond like what you would expect someone to do. Like the game clearly expects you to play it for like an hour a day as opposed to like 8 to 12 hours a day because you have nothing else going on. So it is resulting in some weird FOMO where, like, at least in my friends group, I've seen some people who are super hardcore playing it all the time and being like, my island has everything somehow because I've just done this absurd thing. And then other people are like, I don't know, I've still got the flimsy fishing pole and like I'm just like making my way through this shit. And I'm like, I'm far more in the latter camp, but I'm also an Animal Crossing baby who's like, I don't know what I'm doing really. And like, I didn't even know that you could bury bells and make a money tree until like recently. Like there's like
I didn't
I'm
know
discovering
that until right now.
Great. That's something.
Wait, hold on, Maddie, can you adjust the system timer? Because that was always a thing with the older ones. And then
so
at a certain point, the game would punish you
done
if you
this,
did.
But I have heard it is possible. Like for Chaos Mode AC players, you can adjust the system timer on your Switch, and it will allow you to change the game. I'm not personally interested in doing that, but I do know it's something that people are doing, and that's fine for them if it's fun for them.
Yeah, I think there's a hard distinction between doing that and just playing a whole ton.
Yes, and just grinding, which is like another form of hardcore playing of AC, is just like grinding it out, getting every single fish and then billions more fish, and just filling your little tent with fish cages, fish aquarium.
I would think that to get the most out of using the clock, you would also need to be grinding a lot, just because you want to advance the clock once you've met certain thresholds.
I'm sure.
But and I know that some journalists that we know, like people who are doing guides and stuff, have used that just because they need to see more of the game. Yeah. I personally would never do that. I feel like so much of the appeal for me is that it moves slowly and I don't feel the need to do that. I totally understand both, actually. If someone is like, look, I need something to do, I'm going to do everything in the game and play for 12 hours, even though it's not
fully, endeared to that. Like, like the clock changing, I'm like sympathetic to, but I am mostly just endeared to the people who are just playing this game constantly and seeing how weird the game becomes when you do that. And like when you have an absurd amount of resources because all you're doing is playing this game, and like you pay off your debts a lot faster, I guess, because you just have a bajillion peaches or something. I don't know.
There are definitely times where I want to make some joke on Twitter and then I'm like, I don't know, maybe everybody is like 3 days past this joke. This thing I'm seeing isn't even funny right now, because everyone's like, right? No. I think I need to get past that. But going by my Twitter feed, like everyone has full cities and shit. Was it 9Volt? You know, 9Volt on Twitter is a very funny Twitter user. Was like, me, oh, I guess I'll play Animal Crossing for an hour and get some stuff done. Everybody in my Twitter feed, look at my perfect recreation of Rapture from BioShock. Like, that's how my Twitter feed feels. I'm like, what the fuck is that? Like, whenever someone is doing something.
I don't even know how to get that stuff. I'm still like making an end table or whatever. Anyway, Kirk, you played like 6 more games. Do you want to talk about any of them?
Sure, I'll go really quickly through them, not to mention a bunch of thoughts. I finished Ori and the Blind Forest. It's a great game. I have some complaints with it. You know, it's good, but there are I had some issues. And one person wrote in, a couple of people mentioned this on Twitter, that I do want to shout out Gareth Coker, the composer. He wrote the music for the first Ori 2. These games have beautiful music. He makes really gorgeous soundtracks, and this game is no different. But I really liked it. It was actually another game that I found very calming. It's just a very pleasing Metroid-style game in terms of design, if not in terms of protagonist. And I dug it a lot. Also, having finished it, the Hollow Knight comparisons are not off base. There's a lot of Hollow Knight in this game. And like, again, clearly it was not inspired by Hollow Knight, but I can understand how someone would play it. At some points, you're like going through the spider caves and stuff, and it's like, you're like, this is okay, this is really giving me some Hollow Knight memories. But I mostly mean that in a good way, because I love Hollow Knight, and a game that reminds me of Hollow Knight is also good. So I like that. I played some of the Resident Evil 3 demo. It made me very anxious.
Sounds really scary.
it's great. I mean, it's going to be, I'm sure it'll be good. But I'll talk about that when the actual game comes out. I played a bit of Doom Eternal, which is really, really fun and really violent and intense. It was too intense for me at first, but I've been playing a little bit more and I like it. Played some more Kirby, because we got to finish Kirby. I got to pay off. Maddie, you're the Tom Nook. I've got
to
put in
my... Kirk, how is your sticking to one game at a time resolution?
Oh, you know that.
It's long
well,
day.
I've never said that I was going to do that now. Like, that's just a good thing to try to stick to in slow times. But I have a gaming podcast.
No, it was a last year thing. It was like a
no,
last
I
year
No, I did it
thing.
Last year, and I was doing it this year, too.
I feel like it went pretty well, like, through the slow times, Kirk. I feel like you did a pretty good job of it.
This is not, like, there is no narrative here where I'm, like, breaking some long-standing, resolution that I made. Like, I was the gaming podcast. I got to play a bunch of video games. It's more that when there's a downtime and there aren't a bunch of new games coming out, I try to stick to this thing of one game at a time. And it's typically backlog games, and that's great. I prefer that mode of playing. If I weren't making a gaming podcast, I would just play video games that way.
Yeah.
But no, right now, there's a million things that I got to play them all and tell the people what I think. So the other big game that I do want to talk about just really quickly is Half-Life Alyx, which I've played a couple hours
of. And only you have
the
capacity to play it, so go ahead.
It's so this is the virtual reality new Half-Life game made by Valve. I believe some of the people from Campo Santo are involved in making this, which the former Idle Thumbs hosts, smart people who made Firewatch. Along with, I think, a bunch of other Valve people. This game's amazing. I mean, it's pretty friggin' wild. Like, it's definitely a VR game. So, you know, all the downsides that entails, both that not that many people can play it.
A head crab leaping directly into your face and you having to avoid it. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a video
of that.
That
sounds like a downside to me, especially in this time when I don't want to imagine that. But you know what? You played it. You tell me how you thought it went.
Let me tell you, yeah, that's right. That's about right. A fucking head crab jumps on your face and it's terrifying. That's my thing. So this game is the story of Alyx Vance before Half-Life 2. So this takes place after the events of Half-Life 1, when the Combine, who are these aliens, have come down and sort of invaded Earth and taken over. You are living as Alyx Vance at, I think, age 19, so it's like 5 years before the events of Half-Life 2. She's the daughter of Eli Vance, who's a big scientist in the Half-Life universe and a major character. She's of course, the other main character in Half-Life 2. Gordon Freeman, who you play as, doesn't even talk, so Alyx Vance, especially at the time in 2004... That game holds up. I hope I win our bet so that you both play this game.
It would be really fun to talk about it, yeah.
It's pretty wild that 16 years later, Half-Life 2 holds up as much as it does. It really does. And Alyx, at the time, was this revolution. I mean, she's this completely realistic-looking person, really well-performed, amazingly animated. She's with you through the whole game and provides the kind of emotional impact
grounding
of the game, because Gordon Freeman doesn't react to anything because he's totally silent. So you're now playing as her. And you're in this basically enemy-occupied city, and you have to go on an adventure. And I'm only at the beginning, so early impressions. This shit is crazy. So from a technological standpoint, it's the craziest VR game I've ever seen. I mean, it's like, this is a full-on trip. This is the first time, other than maybe Lone Echo, which is also a really amazing VR game, that I've played a game that felt like a full-on AAA studio at the top of their, like, ability, making a game that's totally designed for VR. And it is nuts. There's stuff that happens in this game.
The killer app arrives.
It definitely is. Like, I'm not telling people they should go spend $1,000 on a VR system. Not that you can even get them in stock right now to play this game. Especially not yet, because I only played a little, but holy shit.
But, like, maybe watch a Twitch streamer play it or something. Check that out.
It won't be the same, but yeah. I tried, like, I posted a video of this. There's sequences. There are these striders in Half-Life, these giant tripods that walk around the city. There are a couple sequences really early in the game, and they're meant to be the, like, we're going to knock you on your ass sequences. You're like on a balcony looking out over the city. It's really crazy. You feel like you're there. And then this huge thing, like, rears up in the street and, like, walks over you, and the sound and, like, the way it looks, it's nuts in VR. Like, it feels like it's just crazy. And so you can't capture that in a video. Mm-hmm. I posted a video of it on Twitter if you want to look at my Twitter feed. I mean, it's like, it looks cool. You're like, oh, that's like a Half-Life strider. But it's not like what it's like
but it's
when
not
it's all
what
around
it's like
you.
When it's actually
this
there.
Deafening legs smashing down on the roof behind you. And you're like, oh my God. And so that's my main takeaway is, having just played through Black Mesa, and of course having played Half-Life 2 through, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 times, the shit you do in Half-Life games is really scary when you need to do it yourself. This game is a horror game, or at least so far what I've played of it is, because it's all going through.
No, it sounds
through,
like it is.
It's
friggin'
scary. It's like all going through a weird, bombed out, enemy-occupied city, which is scary on its own, with, like, police, you know, like this kind of space Gestapo everywhere. And, like, you're hiding from everyone. You're always outnumbered. And then there are friggin' zombies with, like, head crabs on their heads coming at you, like, and they're really scary. And you're, like, shooting at them and backing up and trying to, you have to manually reload your gun. So, like, you run out of ammo and you have to, like, like eject the clip and grab a new one, and there's like a zombie coming at you, and you put it in, you have to pull the slide on the gun to like lock the bullet into the chamber. So you're trying to do this shit while like a zombie is coming at you. So it's very like, it just tense. Is it's a really interesting like case study in how being in a game is so, so different than having the remove of playing a game on a screen, and the level of intensity, like the things we do in a game like Doom Eternal on a screen, that's one thing. But when you're in it, the intensity just has to be dialed down so much, like even compared to Half-Life 2. This is like two zombies coming at you is the most crazy shit like you've ever done. Where in Half-Life 2, you're... Go ahead, Jason.
Well, it's like everything you've said makes it sound cool, but that barrier for entry is so high that like, I mean, a new Half-Life game came out and I've seen nobody talking about it. Like that itself is crazy because nobody's playing it.
Very few people are playing it, right?
Yeah.
And this game,
I saw the peak was like 40,000 people playing it on Steam, which is like hilariously awful. And I feel like they're just by insisting that, I don't know. I mean, you're saying it sounds like it would not be the same outside of VR, but I feel like they...
So I respect it. I respect the call. Like, I respect Valve's call on this. Playing the game, this is a VR game. It's designed to work with this. And they've said, they've been like, we wanted this to be something that pushes technology forward. We didn't just want to make a super good Half-Life third-person game, like, or first-person game. We wanted to make something that would be, like, a new landmark. And it is. Like, I respect it. Like,
and that's fine, but it's just like nobody's going to play it.
Yes.
Like,
well, not nobody, but far fewer people.
And yes. Under 100,000 people.
Yeah.
Which
so far.
For a Half-Life game is unimaginable.
I understand the frustration, of course, like that people would be like, oh my God, this thing sounds great. It's too bad we can't all play it. There's like no reconciling it because I just don't think, I'm sure people will like hack together a version of this that you can play on a screen. It just wouldn't work. Like it's just not, the game is, everything about the game is designed to be played in VR. And
well,
like,
so the big question is, will this eventually usher in an era where VR is cheaper and more accessible and
so,
less motion sick?
Right.
Yeah.
I think that what's maybe likely, just based on snippets of interviews I've seen with Valve people, is that this also leads to another screen-based Half-Life game that I think I think they're going to start releasing Half-Life games
like a
again.
Version of this game or a different other game?
No, like just another Half-Life game in 4 years or something. Or maybe they're already working on it.
And then it'll be like, oh shit, I don't know half the story because I didn't play Half-Life Alyx
Whatever. I don't... Not into the... No,
yeah,
I
mean, that would be great. And I think
I don't
that
think
would...
that's going to be the issue.
Yeah.
The thing is, playing the game... There's no question to me that if I, like, I'm already frustrated by the limitations of my VR setup. I'm just, like, in my home recording studio, which, like, has drums and shit everywhere. And, like, I just don't have a lot of room. If I were playing this thing on an Index in, like, an empty garage, holy shit. Like, it would be so crazy because you could walk around in every scene. Like, I have to kind of do the weird teleporty thing to get around because I just don't have a lot of space. And even that's been amazing. So I'm already, like, ugh, even I don't have the ideal setup. At some point, there will be a way to do this in a more ideal way. And this just, it's just another demonstration of the fact that this technology is like totally going to be mainstream at some point because it's just so transformation. It's so incredible like that, that at some point it will be. And I'm looking forward to that happening. And this game is the first one along with a couple others, Lone Echo among them, that feels like, oh wow, okay, when people really put money into and like talent and time into making these things, like, good God, it's just like the sky is the limit. So I'm excited about it, and I'll play more and report back.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it feels almost like when Wii U was getting some great games. It's like, okay, someone put a lot of time and money and effort into making a great Wii U game, but like, I don't want to play it on Wii U. Anyway, why don't we take a break, and then we will talk about some coronavirus coping and read some listener stories.
Sure.
Hello, I'm Melissa Kirsch.
And I'm Alice Bradley.
And we're the hosts of Lifehackers podcast, The Upgrade. The Upgrade is a show about all of the ways you can improve your life.
That means how to be happier and healthier and more successful and more productive and just generally better in every way.
We talk about stuff like sex. Very few people are like, please jackhammer me for another 45 minutes.
Psychedelics.
You don't just go on the diving board when you're 5 years old and jump in the deep end, because that would be traumatic.
And psychopaths.
Giving you exactly what you need or want without maybe you being aware that you want it.
You can find us wherever you get your podcasts.
And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, it is strange, depressing times all around. And I think one of the ways that we can all kind of cope with that is by knowing that we're not alone and that everybody is feeling anxious and depressed and upset and worried and nervous and all the other lovely emotions that are hitting us. I think just like in a time where humans cannot connect, at least physically, it can be helpful to connect virtually. And that is one of the coping mechanisms that people have been taking. So why don't the three of us real quick just talk about what we've been doing over the past week to survive this whole quarantine lockdown situation. And then we will read a few listener stories and anecdotes. So Maddie, you want to go first? What have things been like for you?
So I'm still doing the same stuff I was last week, like going out for walks more, and I'm obviously getting some more gaming time in than I did last week. But I did want to just mention something else I'm doing in my free time this week alone in my home, which is that former Kotaku staffer Gita Jackson and sometimes Kotaku contributor Nico Deo and I have been organizing a 24-hour Twitch stream that is going to be this Saturday. And weeks ago when we first started entertaining the idea amongst the three of us, we were actually going to try to raise money for Bernie Sanders' campaign, because anybody who listens to this show has probably picked up on the fact that I tend to agree more with Sanders' positions than Joe Biden's or Trump's.
I don't know.
I don't know. That's just me. And so we had this Twitch channel that's called Gamers for Bernie, and it's the digit four, number four, Bernie. And that's the channel we're going to use. But the stream itself is going to be contributing to the four different funds that Bernie Sanders had advocated for COVID-19 relief. And so we're going to be using that as a way to raise a bunch of money. So Nico is going to play Dark Souls. Gita is going to play The Sims and also some truly wild dating Sims. Nice. We have a bunch of other YouTubers and Twitch streamers who are signed up to help us. Like H-Bomber Guy, for example, is pretty well known for doing a really long stream a while back to raise money for Trans Lifeline. And he's going to take part two.
Wait, you didn't say what you're going to play.
I'm just organizing it. I'm just going to be there organizing it, telling jokes, reading donations, and hanging out all day. So if you tune in, you'll probably get to hear from me doing some background shit. So I'm pretty excited about that. And that's been like a fun thing to spend some time doing while all of us are stuck at home. And maybe will be a fun thing for people to watch on Saturday.
Yeah, say the Twitch handle again for people.
Gamers for Bernie with the number four. So put a link for that in show notes.
Kirk, what about you?
Yeah, largely the same. I've been going on walks every morning, which has been good. We've got a stay-at-home order in Oregon, so it's mostly, there's not a lot of people out, but we're all keeping our distance, and everyone's been pretty cool about that. But other than that, music has really been the thing for me. I find myself working way in advance on Strong Songs episodes, just because when I'm in the zone working on that or like learning the song and stuff, I just am totally there and I'm not thinking about all the things that I'm worried about. And also practicing music is the same. So I've been practicing a lot of guitar and just like doing basic patterns and learning songs and stuff has been just a thing that I get in this kind of focused space where I'm not thinking about other things, and that has been great. So
also, it's really like good. You can control everything. You're completely in control when you're.
That's a good point. Well, not when I'm playing challenging guitar parts, I'm largely out of control. But yeah, when I'm making Strong Songs, it is nice to just be like making a thing, and like I know that people like it, and it's a nice thing to make that people get to listen to. So that feels good too.
Yeah. Well, so here in New York, the epicenter of it all, things are pretty nuts. Although I don't really know if things are nuts or not, because I'm not really leaving my apartment. So we've done a couple of things. So last week I was talking about how difficult it was for my wife and I to both be working from home while also taking care of our baby. So my wife kind of made the risky move of going with the baby to her parents' place in Connecticut. And so that's where they are camped out and have been for the past few days. And that is making things way easier on both of us, because we can actually get our jobs done and not have to take care of the baby, because my wife's parents will instead take care of the baby. So that's been kind of weird and surreal, because now I'm home alone, which is like an isolating, strange experience. And so I've found a few ways to cope with that. One is FaceTiming with them every day, and then like FaceTiming with other friends randomly. The other is something that I know a lot of people have been doing, but which I highly recommend, which is playing playing, organizing big games of Jackbox Party Pack. So like Quiplash is the go-to one. I know that's a lot of people's favorites. It's certainly one of my favorites.
So we had a big, I'm a Fibbage guy, man. I'm
you're a Fibbage guy. So we had a big Google Hangout session with like 10 people, and we were all playing Quiplash the other night.
That's awesome.
And yeah, that was super fun. So stuff like that, I think, is a good way of to cope and just like remember that you are not alone. It can actually. So my wife was telling me she was like scheduling a FaceTime call with two of her closest friends who live in different states. So it's not like they would be seeing each other anyway. So if anything, this can be like a good excuse to like keep like get closer to people who you wouldn't normally see, and just like hang out with them, FaceTime with them, do Google Hangouts, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, a lot of ways to just kind of like make a positive situation out of a shitty one. And yeah, I've also been just like binge watching a certain TV show that I'll talk about a little bit later.
Happy to hear it. Happy
and playing
to hear
games.
It.
So yeah, so why don't we read through a few listener stories from some of our interesting listeners out there? Maddie, you want to read this first one?
Sure.
And you can kind of skim the part where the instructions part.
Okay, sure. So this email's from Eddie, who writes, I'm a hospital-based pediatrician that's been very busy during this pandemic. My wife is able to work from home sporadically when either I'm not at work or our toddler is asleep. As much as we absolutely adore our son, quarantine is testing our parenting abilities and our patience to their limit. Without the usual distraction of the playground, grandparents' house, daycare, etc., our son is incredibly bored. Here are some tips for listeners in the same predicament. 1. Draft and keep a schedule for your child, like movement time, coloring, etc. 2. Periodically switch out toy availability so that everything seems new and fun. I do
Very
this with
smart.
My cat, guys. I know everything about parenting because I also do,
I do this
with my cat.
I do this with myself.
Yeah, right? 3. Continue your own hobbies and try to include the kids in them. My wife has been baking to cope with the stress, and my son likes to bang pots and pans and pretend mix things.
I like
4.
That.
Go for walks outside, maintaining a 6 feet away distance from everybody else. This is what everyone in my neighborhood is doing. Like, I'm watching so many people go for walks now. It's kind of cool, actually.
But yeah, people are discovering walking.
So this is where I'm jealous of you guys, because living in Manhattan, you go for a walk and, well, you can't, everybody is, but you can't stay 6 feet away from everybody else. So people have been like trying to take wide berths on the street. I've been walking to the park, but it's like giant clusters of people everywhere. People are still playing basketball, which I think is so dumb.
Really dumb.
So incredibly stupid. But yeah, going for walks here has been a little bit more difficult than it would be out in the suburbs.
Yeah, it's kind of nice out in the burbs, but I get that it can't be that way for anyone. So anyway, Eddie's tip number 5 is don't stress out about screen time recommendations. Sesame Street won't kill them. Yeah. And also, this is about survival. We can't burn ourselves out in the first few weeks. And then I can read this last graph, because why not? I want to finish by asking you guys to ask your listeners to reach out to any spouses or partners or family members of healthcare workers or anyone who works in a hospital that they know to check in and give them support in any way they can. When hospital workers go to work, they're at the highest risk of getting sick, even if they're in a younger age bracket, because of a greater cumulative viral load exposure. Whether they're doctors, nurses, orderlies, security, food services, custodial staff, etc. This is what me and my colleagues signed up for, but it's not necessarily what our partners signed up for. They're bearing the brunt of home life and childcare, all the while worrying that we will get sick and introduce it into the household. I know my wife is struggling, but she continues to put on a brave face and fight through it. I'm sure she isn't alone. So reach out and ask how they're doing. Do Zoom meetings. Let them vent, because this sucks.
We've heard from a few people who are like in the healthcare world, and man, thank you to everybody out there who is doing that work.
And
I
all their partners
imagine.
Who are picking up the slack
for
at home.
Yes, for supporting them.
For
amazing. Amazing
Kirk,
stuff.
You want to read this next one?
Sure. This is from Granger, who writes, love the show. My name's Granger. I'm an emergency medicine doctor in the heart of Chicago. You asked listeners what they were doing to stay sane during the quarantine. I've had a little time off, but soon enough I will be headed back to the ER right in the midst of the pandemic. I figured during this time of social distancing, what could be a better game to start than one about connecting the world? So I finally got started on my copy of Death Stranding. So far, I'm really enjoying the journey the game takes you on. Speaking of connecting the world, we have a lot of tools to stay connected to each other, whether it's Roll20 for D&D, Discord, or Google Duo. It's always nice to chat with friends over more than just text. Finally, may I recommend the game Speedrunners, which is available on Steam, to all those who have not played it. It's easy to pick up and incredibly fun when you get three or four people in on the action. I don't know that game, but thanks for the recommendation.
But this is a multiplayer game's time to shine, an online multiplayer game. Get in on that, you know?
Totally.
Why not?
True. So yeah, thanks, Granger. And, you know, thanks for everything you're doing as a doctor in the heart of Chicago. Jeez.
I kind of want to get back to Death Stranding, but it definitely feels like too real right now. Like it's too, it's too similar to real life, but I don't know. Maybe I'll get back to it someday. It's, the game's wild. Have fun with it, Granger.
Kirk, maybe we should play some Destiny.
It might be fun. I got in Discord just with our Destiny crew while they were playing, and I was just playing Black Mesa. And I just hung out, and I was kind of glad I wasn't playing Destiny because it just sounded stressful, and I'm kind of over Destiny.
Sure.
But
just Mike getting mad at the screen that he didn't get the proper role.
Right, the game's in such a bad place. This sucks. Right, what are we supposed to be doing? And I was like, I'm just having fun playing Half-Life. And like, then occasionally I would just be like, man, so have you guys watched Altered Carbon yet? I don't know about that second season. I'm sure they loved that. I'm sure they loved that.
All right, let's do a few more. This is from Andrew. First off, love the podcast. Also, I hope Kirk wins the bet this year so I can hear all about Jason playing Half-Life 2.
Right there with you, Andrew. Right there with you.
Kirk, your musical choices are just fire. Keep it up and send Mark Cerny both of your ears because you just hear things. The rest of us don't.
I'm going to do that. Cut them off and send them to Mark.
So Andrew says that he works at a emergency vet clinic. He works at two emergency vet clinics, and he's worked in emergency vet medicine for the last 18 years. Yeah, of course. Well, they're essential. I mean, they can't close. So he's saying they're staying open as long as they can until staffing becomes problematic. Our company's put in great packages. All of us are helping each other, et cetera, et cetera. The biggest change for us is how we are seeing patients. Only staff is allowed in the building. So when clients pull up, they call our front desk and we send out assistants or technicians to do curbside triages. And then the staff member brings in the pet for further evaluation, but with the vets on site, which is really interesting. And so, like he says, it's hard on owners to not visit their pets while they're staying with us, but they understand that we're doing the best we can. And Andrew says he considers himself very lucky that he's able to keep working, and he hopes that we continue to be safe and well because our podcast gets him energized to take on his days every week as they work hard to take care of all of our fur babies. Aww. Thank you, Andrew, and all the vets out there still doing hard work, among many other people who are still doing hard work, grocery workers and other essential services. Maddie, you want to read this next one?
Sure. So it's from Annie, who writes, I hope you all are doing well despite the circumstances. So my favorite game is The Last of Us, and I felt it appropriate to boot up my upteenth playthrough today, but it makes me wonder how long it'll be before we're reminiscing on coffee shops and school like Joel does, wandering through a quarantined America. Not very long. Is there not a week? Is about how long it takes.
I'm already reminiscing about brunch.
So she continues, I've been a homebody for a lot of my life, content staying indoors and playing video games. After college, I now prefer going outdoors, hammocking, walking, hiking, traveling, and being social outside the house. While quarantined, I'm trying to tap back into this homebody lifestyle, forcing myself to enjoy it. But a lot of my years spent staying indoors have been a result or symptom of my anxiety, so it's not been mentally easy going back to that lifestyle. I am intensely grateful for apps like Discord, Snapchat, and Netflix Party to keep connected with friends and stay social while social distancing. I've heard a lot of good stuff about Netflix Party lately. I did not even know it existed until recently, but it seems like a pretty
good
way.
You watch something together?
You can watch something with other people. There's a few services, like Rabbit is a really crappy one that I used, I think, before Netflix Party existed. I haven't tried Netflix Party yet, but I've had some friends who want to organize virtual movie nights, and so I'll let you guys know if we manage to get our shit together.
And this is it's a Chrome plugin, I think, right? Or like a Fire, it's like a browser plugin that lets you sync up. I think that's how it works.
That would make sense.
If that's, I guess you can probably people can Google Netflix Party. Anyways, carry on.
Who knows? We don't know.
Kirk, you want to read this next one?
Oh, yeah, sure. I'll read this. So this comes from a listener who asked not to be named, who writes, I've never written in before, but when you asked how people are coping with COVID-19, it made it hard to deny the chance to vent a little. I work for a company that's basically a one-stop shop for other companies, a distribution company. We employ both office workers and warehouse workers, and I'm part of their marketing department. For the last 2 weeks or more, and this email came last week when we asked for this, so it's been a week since this. That's just to kind of put this in context. For the last 2 weeks or more, what is time anymore? I've listened to podcasts like yours, friends and family, as they've all taken precautions and preemptive measures to help quell the spread. Meanwhile, at my job, outside of a few extra hand sanitizer stations, it's been business as usual. Dozens of employees packed together in small cubicles, no more than 3 feet apart, in rooms with poor circulation. And I can't imagine what it's like for the hundreds of warehouse workers who all work at the same time because our CEO doesn't believe in the need for shifts. My work can easily be done from home. And finally, after a rumor that an employee had tested positive, I took my laptop and walked out. An hour later, our team was told we could work from home, but that we had to log all of our tasks each day and report them to the CEO. There is no trust. Many companies have been proactive, enacting social distancing and work-from-home policies for weeks. Everyone is joking about boredom and coping with isolation, but there are many workers who are stuck at places that only care about their bottom line and what's legal at the moment. There are places that are willing to let their employees get infected because we're all young here anyways. This whole situation has exposed me in a pretty profound way to a scenario where I was desperate for government action. The new executive orders in New York State give me hope that things will change at my company quickly, but I wonder how they will be enforced. Luckily, I'm home now, but there are surely millions of people who are still being forced to choose between their safety and a paycheck.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned it on the show, but we've been reporting at Kotaku a lot about GameStop and their
They were doing sort of similar things.
Yeah, I mean, they've just been pushing up against every possible law, so they've been waiting for like each state to basically enforce their lockdown practices for a while. Until finally on Sunday they said, or Saturday they said, hey, we're switching to drive-by curbside service only, so you have to like go to a GameStop and knock on the door and then you'll get it. They'll like bring you your games outside, which is, it's all been absurd. And I mean, they're in a tough spot because they've already been in precarious financial situations for a long time, so chances are high that if they shut down, they would not last much longer. They would not reopen anytime soon. So yeah, just really, really tough for a lot of different places. All right, here is Austin, who says, I'm a butcher at a grocery store and have been on the front lines of this nationwide pandemic. I've been pulling 50 to 60 hours for the past 2 weeks and have been trying to help people secure simple things like chicken or ground beef. People are upset going without essential meats and groceries because other people are hoarding. Higher ups aren't putting limitations on buying or stricter protections for us as we deal with hundreds of panicked people every day. Video games used to be my escape, but I'm almost too exhausted to pick them up as of late. When I see people talk about boredom and all this time to shelter in place, I have to balance my excessive hours at work with my now online college workload on top of constantly checking in with people I know and love to make sure they're okay and safe. Podcasts help the long days go by quicker, and I thank y'all for keeping Split Screen going at a time when people need even a little escapism. You're very welcome. I hope to hear ways that other people can cope that perhaps I can replicate, but I wanted to give the perspective of someone that's struggling to find the time to even deal with coping in the first place. I totally empathize with that.
Especially really, the food service part of this. I think it's just like, shout out to everyone who works at a grocery store right now. It's such a reminder that there are jobs that like our society does not value appropriately. And then suddenly when the chips are down, it's so much more important that there are people who can just get you food than that there are people who, you know, whatever, can do so many other things. And like, there are just people at grocery stores are so exposed right now and are doing such crucial work. Whenever I go to the grocery store, I'm like, everybody here is like a friggin' hero. Like, they're making sure that we all have food. And so, I mean, I don't know about, like, it just sounds like, you know, Austin is dealing with a lot of stuff right now, but just like respect to you, man. Like, I hope you're hanging in there.
Yeah, Animal Crossing will be there for you when you're ready, man. Like, don't.
It's true.
It's all good. Do what you can.
Yeah. A couple of things. Yeah, a couple of thoughts for those of us out there who are in pretty good financial situations. I think finding places to donate to like food service people would be a good idea. A couple of things that that I've been trying to do are, one, I've ordered delivery a couple times and I try to tip, like, I think I've been doing 30 or 40% mm-hmm. tips,
yeah.
which I think is really important now. And then something else that I've seen people do. And so we have someone come by every other week to help clean our apartment. And so I told her not to come and we would keep paying her anyway. And I recommend right. that anyone else who has that sort of situation do the same, because it's just it just feels like the right thing to do. And yeah, man, I hope there are, I need to find some good like funds for like grocery service workers, especially. Matt, do you want to read this next one?
Sure. So this is from Sean. He says his job entails preparing for the care of sick patients in the hospital when and if this wave of patients arrives. Needless to say, the last month has added considerable years to my life. Video games have been a calming presence in my life, and for the past 2 years, I've experienced great joy listening to your podcast on Thursday afternoons. It always eases my stress at the end of a hectic day. Thanks so much. You're welcome, Sean. I do have a question. Wouldn't now be a great opportunity for publishers to release digital games? Think about it. Lots of schools are canceled, people are working from home, and social distancing is all the rage. It seems to me that a lot of games could be sold right now. It also seems to be the perfect opportunity to push out games that are otherwise ready but have been delayed for whatever reason, e.g. Metroid Prime Trilogy for Switch that we all assume exists.
Just for instance.
Yeah, you know what, Sean? I agree with you. We all know that exists, and I'm just waiting for Nintendo to put it out. I'm ready to hit that download button. Let us have it. What are they doing?
Yeah, it's so interesting. So I think a lot of people were clamoring last week for Nintendo to release Animal Crossing like 3-4 days early digitally. I think that the reason that companies wait to release digital on day of retail is because it would really piss off the retailers if Nintendo was suddenly like, oh, you can buy Animal Crossing on the eShop, but not at GameStop or Walmart. But if the retails aren't actually operating, I wonder how the calculus plays into that. Mm-hmm. And then I think GameStop actually started selling some games a day early anyway. So I don't know. That's an interesting question.
Oh, this is also happening in Hollywood, if you've seen the movie stuff. Like the whole Hollywood distribution model is basically being rewritten in real time. There are things coming out, like movies, theatrical releases are being released mm-hmm. digitally, or that one, the crappy controversial one about people hunting people, didn't that like come out? The Hunt, is that what it's called? It came out the same day, I think, on digital and in movie theaters. So Universal, I think, changed.
So
this is happening across a lot of entertainment industries.
So I would be curious to hear if anyone out there is listening and like is working on a game that is due to come out in the near future. Have you considered, like, has there been discussion of releasing your game early? And then I think what's actually going to happen more is the flip side, where we're going to start seeing delays really soon. Of production pipeline issues. There are a lot of things
for the games that are
really
already almost done. It's like, why not
just go ahead? It depends, like, where in the process they are, right? Like, there's disc manufacturing is always a big question. Like, how many of those plants are going to stay open and for how much longer? And then if you talk about games that are a little bit further out, there are a lot of like logistical problems, like Sony and Microsoft and Nintendo. If you want to release a game on one of their platforms, you have to go through the certification process to get your game approved by them. And like, how much clogging is there in that process now? If they're all working from home, can they even still do that? Like, what's happening with that? So I'm very curious if anyone has any insight out there, hit us up at splitscreen@kotaku.com, because I'm very curious to hear your perspectives. Kirk. Listener email.
Here's Adam. Hi, Jason, Maddie, and Kirk. Thank you so much for forging ahead with new episodes of the podcast. It really means a lot to me and helps maintain at least a tiny sense of normalcy to be able to listen to my three favorite co-hosts talk about video games. Well, of course, man. We're happy to do this. I enjoyed your discussion of coping with the quarantine and wanted to share an activity that my friends and I have been really enjoying. It turns out that Jackbox games lend themselves really well to playing remotely. We spent several hours last night playing Quiplash over Zoom and had a blast. Quiplash is our favorite by far, but we're looking forward to trying out some of the other ones. I highly recommend it. I hope you continue to stay safe, healthy, and sane through all of this, and keep podcasting. Don't worry, we will, and try Fibbage, because Fibbage is really fun too.
Yeah.
My Jackbox is the way to go.
They're a good level of engagement.
I also like Trivia Murder Party. We've been having fun with. Have you played that one? It's pretty fun.
I never have.
I do like that one. Well, Trivia Sounds Murder great. Party is, it's basically You Don't Know Jack. It's the same structure as You Don't Know Jack.
Except it's like people like dying in a basement.
The guy's doing the Mike Fahey can do so well. Those games are good because I've still been playing Lords of Waterdeep with my board game group, which is fun, but that's a pretty crunchy game. Mm-hmm. It would be fun to play something that's a little lighter and riffier with like more jokes, because there's a lot of times where we're playing it and we're all kind of just sitting there like thinking about our next turn, and like it's cool because that's what we do in that group anyway. But I think next time we might actually try Jackbox for that reason.
Yeah, Jackbox is also good for bigger groups, so if you have definitely like 8 true. 10 people, I think they cap out most of their games at 8, and then other people can just be in the audience. All right, and then one last one. This is from Ian. He says, "Hey guys, thanks for being a respite in these dark, dark times. I manage a grocery store and I'm directly responsible for keeping the shelves full, a job that is recently requiring a Naughty Dog level of crunch. Due to how much time I'm spending trying to get through others through this crisis, I barely have time to worry about what would happen if I were to get the virus, even though I'm so high risk. I'm too busy explaining to 80-year-olds why I have no toilet paper for them. Best advice I've found is, even though not many can relate with the stress that I am personally going through, I do have people I work with who do. We started a group chat to just complain as needed. None of us are truly alone in this, and having a support group is going to be more important than ever. Also, FYI, if I ever lose my job, it's because I got on the intercom system right before Elton John's I'm Still Standing starts, because this one goes out to all the corona survivors out there.
Don't you know I'm still standing?"
That's good.
Yeah, I like that idea of like setting up a support group for yourself of other people who like might understand what you're going through,
especially
in a way
if you're
that
in
the rest
a high
of us
impact
can't.
Job uh-huh. right now. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you're in healthcare or
anything,
groceries.
Yeah, anything to blow off steam.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. Why don't we take another break and then get into a little bit of off topic, including one much anticipated off topic bit of discussion.
Very exciting.
And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, I've done it. I have watched season one of The Wire.
Woo! It'd be really funny if you despised it. Do you?
I did not despise it.
Great. Great.
I enjoyed it quite a bit. It was quite bleak. Quite a bleak ending. It's a very dense, poetic, very fascinating show. A couple of thoughts. So first of all, it's interesting. When there's a beloved show, you have certain preconceived notions or like certain bits and pieces that you've seen on the internet as far as like memes and stuff. Yeah. I remember this happened to me with Breaking Bad. Yeah, GIFs. Oh man, that one, I had no idea that GIF of, now I know Weebay. It's Weebay, going
But you haven't gotten to the episode where he does that yet. I think that's in season 2.
No, I have. No. Okay, it's in season 1. Yes, I have.
It's all running together. Listen, I mainlined the show. I don't know when anything happens, but yeah.
So yes, that happened, and I was like, oh my, like my mind was blown when I saw that. I was like, holy shit.
It's a great gift.
But yeah,
there's also Bunk,
as far as,
but there's Bunk when he's like, motherfucker. Like he like is shaking his head. I remember doing that to you a few times, and I don't know if that happens in season 1, but that's a big one too. Anyway, go ahead.
So the preconceived notions I had, so this happened to me with Breaking Bad, where like I had seen GIFs and thought certain things before I actually tuned in. I think I tuned into that like right the second, like the minute after it ended or something like that.
Good time.
So, and like I'd seen that line of Walter's that like I am the one who knocks. I am the one who knocks, and I had no idea what it meant. And then I was like, oh, that makes sense. Okay, so with The Wire, it was two things. It was one, you come at the king, you best not miss, which I didn't expect to happen. I don't know if it happens more if he says it more than once, but I didn't expect him to say it in that context because it was kind of a strange context for him to say it. Like I expected something. I expected, based on what I had seen, the bits and pieces I put together in my head, I expected that the show is about Omar running a gang and Avon running a gang, and they like went at each other, and then at one point Avon's people tried to take on Omar, like put together some crazy scheme to
take
him
on,
and they can't because you come at the king, you best not miss, and they fail too, and so he gets revenge. What actually happened,
so you thought Omar was the king in that situation,
right? So I thought he was one of the like drug lords, and I thought they were rival drug lords like going at it. I had no idea that Omar was this like wacko, like crazy
vigilante,
like,
badass queer hero of our times. Omar's the greatest.
He is. I knew he was gay, but I didn't know he was just like this off his rocker, like getting around, like Omar's coming, like, man.
I mean, like, insofar as the show has a protagonist, at least in the first season or so, I feel like Omar is kind of it. I mean, I guess it's McNulty, I'm like, Omar's kind of the person you can root for in a certain way, but that just shows my politics, I guess. I don't know.
Well, and Omar also is, Omar is great. There's an interesting thing that David Simon has talked about where the show is so grounded and so realistic. And yeah, in season one, McNulty feels like the protagonist, which is extremely less true and or not true at all, really, in later sequences. He's still an important character, but in later seasons. But it winds up becoming much more what it already kind of feels like. I should say I watched the first episode yesterday. I rewatched it. And now I'm going to totally just rewatch the entire show. I was like, oh my God, this show is so good. I can't.
Well, it's good timing,
I was like, every line
I'm
like, yeah,
it's
no, so we'll all good. Have to watch it. But he's talked about how, and I think Alan Sepinwall, the TV critic who's done really great coverage of
that
show.
Yeah, I've been reading his recaps, which are helpful, because there are things I miss that like he catches.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and like, there are just things that now that I, even on like, this will be my third time, I think, watching the show, like there are just things you don't get until you watch it again. Mm-hmm. Like they set up everything that happens in the final episode of season one at the very beginning of the show. And they set up stuff that happens in like the fourth season, like in the first episode of the show. But Omar is the one character on the show who feels larger than life. Mm-hmm. And like Brother Muzan, this isn't a spoiler, but there's like a thing with Brother Muzan and like that character a little later, he's also kind of larger than life. And there's some stuff that happens there where you're like, but it's exciting.
It feels a little superhero-y, like a little vigilante-esque. Yeah.
In a fun way, I think anyways, as like a contrast to literally everything else in the show, which is like, it feels like it could just be real, even though I know they take liberties and stuff. Like of it's course. Just so grounded. But to have this one guy, like you said, this like queer superhero vigilante, like amazing with his scar, and it's Michael K. Williams.
Wild
it's so
that
good.
He's in a 2002 era show. Like watching it now, I'm just like, it's so cool that this even.
Yeah, this
existed.
Is like a modern like, super.
There's a lot of like Kima as well. Kima and her wife.
Yeah.
And,
some of it doesn't really make sense. Like he comes in and everyone's running away when they could have just taken him down. Like if they really wanted to.
Because
some of
it's
it,
all. It's kind of about how much like being in a gang is like about building your persona though, and it's like about the symbolism that you cultivate within
that's
a
true.
Neighborhood, and it's not so much. And it's also the show does a good job of showing like how dangerous it actually is when a shootout happens and like how few bullets it actually takes in order for people to die, which is just the one. And like it's very different from other action sequences in that way in terms of like how it shows you how short a shootout can be and like how intense it can be. And like Omar just carrying a shotgun around everywhere he goes, like you don't want to be around that guy. Like you just don't. That makes him a superhero just by default because he's already like, I fear nothing and I constantly have a gun.
The way he walks, he really reminded me, I was texting with Kirk, he reminds me of Joker in The Dark Knight. Like his gait, the way he walks, like the Joker must have been very heavily inspired by.
I wonder if Heath Ledger liked The Wire.
Yeah,
that, like you know
I'm
what?
Sure
why
he
not?
Did.
We can't ask him now.
So a couple of thoughts. So first of all, Stringer Bell is the most captivating character. Like, there's a lot of good acting,
just wait.
But every time Idris Elba is on screen. Oh, yeah.
Idris Elba. I think he's pretty talented. I don't know. That guy's going places.
Kind of got a strong screen presence.
God, what a role. And there are a lot of good, there's a ton of good acting on the show. All the performances have been incredible. Michael B. Jordan with just like another standout role for him.
Baby Michael B. Jordan, little tiny baby Michael
B. Jordan.
Oh, my
God. I'd forgotten. The scene in the premiere, since I watched the first episode, the scene where he knows that Alexander Hamilton wasn't a president. It's like there's so much stuff like that that's so fucking sad when you know the full arc of the season. And he's, it is wild how young he is on the show.
I know.
And so sad, of course.
But despite all of these incredible performances, Idris Elba still just like stands out above
there's
all the rest.
Man,
like I cannot stop watching every time Stringer Bell is on screen.
Yeah, he's
Larry,
amazing.
What's his name? The actor who plays D'Angelo. There's.
I like him too. He's very
good.
He's
so good. I like him more each time I watch it because he's such a gentle guy, even though he's pretending. And like, it really comes through in his performance. And at first I was like, I just don't know if I buy this guy. And by the end of the season, I think the first time I watched it, I was like,
you kind of get it and you believe it.
That's the idea. Like, he's not cut out for this. He's just like, he shouldn't really be here. And there's a scene where he comes back to the towers in the first episode and Stringer is down on the street and Stringer like redirects him to the pit. And it's I think it's like the only time in the whole show that Stringer is ever like actually down like where shit is happening. Like on this, I was like, man, this is wild even now. Just
well, Stringer
knowing,
does go to the pit a few times.
Oh, he does? Okay. Because
like,
I guess
the
in
more
season
the show
one,
goes on, the more elevated Stringer becomes.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't want to hear anything about future. Don't
no
say
spoilers.
Anything about future.
Oh my God, I'm so excited for you to watch the rest, and I am excited for myself to rewatch it.
So I'm gonna keep watching, obviously. I'm excited. I think you told me season 5 is one about journalists, and you said it wasn't as great as the rest of them, but I'm excited
just
for the journalist season.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but I'm still excited for the journalist stuff.
Yeah,
and yeah, I'm excited to see where it goes, because it feels very much, it actually feels like The Sopranos in a lot of ways. But one of them being that the first season of The Sopranos was just like written to be a standalone series. And now it's like, okay, we fit all of our best ideas into this one season. Now where are we going to go? And from there, like season one of The Sopranos is definitely the best. And then the rest is incredible also. But like, it's very clear that they just stuffed as much as possible into that one season.
I wonder. I'm very curious to see.
Well, I'm very curious to see because season one, obviously I haven't seen the rest, so I don't know what the rest is going to be. But the reason I bring that up is because just like The Sopranos, season one of The Wire is like one self-contained story that feels like the show could have ended just there. And
it would have been
a fantastic show.
So
I'm excited to see what else they do with it.
Yeah, I would say that my favorite two seasons of The Wire are seasons 3 and 4. And maybe, I think season 4 is my favorite season. That's a freaking incredible season of television. Like, it is amazing.
Maddie, now that I'm watching The Wire, you should watch The Sopranos so we can talk about that.
That would be fun too. I would rewatch The Sopranos.
I'm partial to it, so it's hard for me to make a comparison of
which is better. They're different in an interesting way.
I'm sure I'd enjoy it.
Yeah, but The Sopranos is a comedy, and The Wire is a tragedy. That's the biggest
difference.
The Wire
is funny, though. It's a funny
show. No, it is funny, but The Sopranos is fundamentally... The Sopranos is one of the funniest shows I've ever seen.
I get what you're saying. This will be... When you finish The Wire, this is a very interesting comparison, since the shows were contemporaries, and they're very, very different in a fundamental way that I think is interesting.
Yeah,
but we can have that discussion later.
Well, we'll have to do a big spoiler cast once I finish The Wire.
Sure, that would be fun. The Wire. It's coming.
Yeah,
it's just Omar's coming.
It's just like Omar, it is coming.
So it's interesting. It's just such a funny like part of pop culture when you see something quoted on the internet for so long and you kind of assume that it's said in one context and then it's said in a completely different context. Like, it's just so strange.
The context collapse of the internet.
That's going to keep happening to you, man, because the number of references to The Wire that the people make, like as you go on in further seasons, and you're going to start noticing it like as you're scrolling Twitter, you're going to see people like referring to The Wire like even now, which I know because it happens to me like once
I'm excited.
A month. And I'm always excited. The Wire.
The Weebay gif blew my mind. I had no idea that was from The Wire. Like, I just saw that gif constantly and just had
no idea. That's so funny.
Anyway, let's move on. Maddie, I see you were watching another one of my favorite TV shows ever.
Yeah, isn't this enough for you, Jason? I don't have to watch The Sopranos because I'm watching Curb Your Enthusiasm.
I'm
back on like only wanting calming media. I actually didn't watch any
of The Wire
this week at all.
Perfect coronavirus show.
I've only been mainlining Curb Your Enthusiasm episodes. They're all on Hulu. I have nothing really to say.
So you just started from the beginning?
Yeah, Curb.
I just started at the beginning,
and I'm like already on season 3. Like, I'm just gonna finish it by next week because it's like all I can handle right now, and it's so funny. And like Larry David is great. And my mom kind of tipped me onto it because she's been watching a bunch of it, and I'm just like, you know what? That sounds like it's really going to hit the spot. So yeah, shout out to you and my mom,
Maddie,
I guess.
You are in for some real treats. Are you a Seinfeld fan? Did you like grow up watching Seinfeld?
Yeah, I mean, kind of. We didn't really watch TV in my house, but like I do, I know I've like seen Seinfeld in my life. Like I do like know about it. And like I've seen some Curb episodes in my life. So like, it's not like I don't know the premise of the show and like how it works and stuff, but I've never sat down and been like, I'm going to watch all of Curb Your Enthusiasm. And now is the time.
This is perfect. It's a perfect time to watch all of Curb Your Enthusiasm.
It is.
And then you can watch The Sopranos afterwards. But
But or just like every other, just like the Jason Trier special, just like one up here, one up there. And just like see where I go. See what I become, you know?
Curb is like go-to at our apartment. It's just something we put on randomly, like while
we
do
other stuff.
It's a
really good background show. Yeah,
it's
I get
phenomenal.
Why you do
that. Man, it's such a good show. But season 7, I think, is my favorite. Definitely up there. And that you will appreciate even more as a semi-Seinfeld fan.
Cool.
But man, there's so many good plot lines. Just so, I think it's what you're on season 3, you said? Mm-hmm. What's like the overarching storyline of that one?
Larry David trying to build
the restaurant?
A restaurant.
Yeah, the restaurant. Okay. So season 4 has another incredible, I won't even say what it is, but man, some of the overarching stories are incredible. Four is one of my favorites. Oh man, you're in for so much good stuff. I'm so excited for you to keep watching. And so many good like celebrity appearances, and also people before they were celebrities just like appearing on the show. Like, I think Molly McCarthy has like a single line in an episode. All these other just like random super famous people before they were famous just happened to appear on Curb Your Enthusiasm. Did you know that the entire show is improvised, by the way?
Yes. Okay. I know that they like have a chart for every scene, and then they just want
they
to make
like
sure certain
outline.
Things happen. Sometimes it's more obvious than others that they're improvising. Like a lot of times Larry David and Richard Lewis will be like cracking each other up, but like they're keeping it in, and it also like feels yep. realistic that they would be telling jokes that the other thinks is funny. And it adds a lot of warmth to the show. Makes yes. it a very so positive good. Watch.
So good. All right, Kirk, what about you? What are you up to these days?
Man, my like coping watch has been Schitt's Creek. We're almost done. I didn't put this on yeah. the sheet, but what a wonderful show. Oh my God. We're at the end of season 5, which is the last season on Netflix, mm-hmm. and it's just David and Patrick. It's like the greatest maybe couple I've ever seen in a TV show. And
they're great.
It's a wonderful show. But the thing I'm going to talk about just really quickly, since we're going so long, is Altered Carbon season 2, which I watched. Ellen, I liked the first season of this, and then I read the book. This is based on a sci-fi series where the premise is that, like, I have talked about this on the show, but I'll refresh everybody. The premise is that we're way in the future, and there's a technology that allows you to put your consciousness into a kind of chip that goes in your neck. And then that is yourself, and your body is now no longer yours. It doesn't really matter. And so people live hundreds and hundreds of years, and it's referred to as your sleeve. Your stack is the thing in your neck, and your sleeve is the body that you're in. And you can then be re-sleeved in a new sleeve. So the entire concept of like mortality in humanity is changed. And that's the basically, if most sci-fi stories are, what if this one thing, what would the world mm-hmm. look like? Altered Carbon is very, what if this one thing, what if death meant something completely different?
Right.
What would the world look like? And it's very like action-y, very kind of Wachowski influence, lots of cool fight scenes. And it's very noir. The first season was straight up noir, set in San Francisco. And I really liked season 1. It was like this very high production value, kind of sordid, a lot of sex and nudity and like gratuitous fighting and stuff. It was kind of porny in a way that I enjoyed. Season 2 recast the main character, Anthony Mackie, from the Marvel movies. What's his
name?
Falcon.
I guess it's easy to recast yeah. when you're exactly. just stealing
the
so yeah.
Takeshi, the guy's name is Takeshi Kovacs. And in the books, the book is really cool because you aren't seeing him. So he goes in his memory and you like see him being all these different people. And it just works better because his consciousness is always there because it's a book. And it,
right.
you see into his mind. Where as an actor, it's very different. The actor has to kind of carry the affect across. So Anthony Mackie from the Marvel movies is playing him in this because he's another well-known actor, I think just left the show. So now there's a new actor playing him, which is a cool premise, a cool idea on its own. And there's also another actor who also played him in the first season because he's been so many different people that's still in season 2. So season 2, I didn't like as much as season 1. It felt like their budget was cut significantly. It's still pretty fun. Like, they still play with the premise, but they're not having quite as much sort of sordid fun. It's a little more of people like having dour conversations or just feeling bummed out about things. A bright spot is that Renee Lise Goldsberry, who was Angelica Schuyler in the original Broadway cast of Hamilton, actually, she's in a bunch of stuff. You'd know her. She's in The Good Wife. She's a great actress. And she's in the first season, too. She plays Kelchris Falconer. She's in this season a lot more. And she's just incredible. Like, she's a fun actor to watch. And she and Anthony Mackie are like really good together. So that was cool. Overall, it's kind of medium on it. I'll keep watching it. I want to keep reading the books because the books are pretty fun. But if people are looking for a fun sci-fi show, season 1 of that show is particularly a fun watch if you're just looking for some kind of escapism. It's good. Cool. So that's what I got.
Good to know. Cool. Okay. Well, I think that is it for this week's episode. Kirk, take it away.
Got a music pick. I've been listening to a lot of music on my walks. A good buddy of mine that we went to music school together, we've been doing a listening club where each Aww. Day we trade off. He'll send
Cute.
Me an album or I send him an album and we listen yeah. to it and then we talk about it, which is what we always used to do that in school. Like, Strong Songs is even kind of because I like wanted to recreate that atmosphere of like listening to music with your friends. And that one of the albums he sent me was Beck's Mutations from 1998. This album, like, Man, I didn't give Beck enough credit back when I was really young, and then I discovered Midnight Vultures and was like, holy shit, this album is so good. And I hadn't really listened to Mutations all the way through. It's such a good album. It's kind of a great album for right now. So I wanted to have a music pick from that album. This is maybe the best known song from it. It's called Tropicalia, and I really like this song. It's got a cool groove, and it's good stuff. So this is Tropicalia by Beck from his 1998 album, Mutations. To throw. You wouldn't know what to say to yourself. Love is a poverty you couldn't sell. Misery waits in big hotels. Be addicted. Beck, man. Do you guys remember Loser? Do you remember?
Of course, yes. I was about to bring that up.
Mostly I remember Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind soundtrack. That was my entryway.
The Weird Al version?
What's the Weird Al version?
It's not a straight up parody. He put it on a polka. No, he put it on a polka.
Oh, he did a polka version. I love his polka versions. Like, his polka Bohemian Rhapsody is so good.
How come you don't do Weird Al for Music Picks, Kirk? Weird Al's a good music pick.
Maybe I will.
Well, you should do. I mean, he has some fantastic original songs.
I probably will at some point. Of an original of his? Yeah. His covers are good, but his originals.
Everything You Know Is Wrong. That's a great original song, for example. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, he, when I was like, I don't know, 6, 5, 7, my exposure to pop music was through Weird Al's polkas.
I learned a lot of Rolling Stones songs from Hot Rocks Polka from the UHF soundtrack. He just does a Rolling Stones medley. I've never heard like Shalubi, I'm Shattered, or whatever, Sympathy for the Devil. Yeah, when I heard Loser, I thought it was bad because I was, I don't know, 14 or something at the time, and I was like,
jazz. A weird song.
I was into jazz and whatever, and I just heard it. And I was like, man, this guy Beck is so bad at music. He just sucks. Like, since it's kind of like rough and ready, the whole performance. But now I listen to him, and it's like, this dude is like a genius. Like, he's like an amazing musician. So anyway, Beck is good. Weird Al is definitely also good.
Yes.
Let's talk about Weird Al every time Kirk does a music pick from now on. Let's just talk about the Weird Al interpretation of it.
You should do a Weird Al themed Strong Songs. That would be
cool. I mean, I'm sure I will at some point. I grew up listening to Weird Al. I'll probably do They Might Be Giants first, speaking of like oddball musical acts.
That's a good one.
There's a lot.
What's your favorite They Might Be Giants song?
Oh, that is an impossible question. Who knows?
Because it's so obviously Dr. Worm, or
Dr. Worm is good. Well, Birdhouse in Your Soul is maybe classic. Just because. But it's everything on Flood. Don't get me started. We've gone so long. I'll like talk for 50 minutes about the movie Giants or Fingertips. It would be really fun to do a Strong Songs about Fingertips.
Well, I was just gonna ask, have you seen the movie UHF? Have you seen the movie?
Oh my god! As a kid, I was obsessed with that movie.
Stanley Spadowski. Oh my god, it was my obsession as a kid also.
Yes.
I have to go now. My planet needs me.
Yes, and he just beams away. Oh man. Yep.
You get nothing. Absolutely nothing.
Nothing. Yeah, it's definitely a movie.
It's definitely a movie. All right, Kirk, Maddie, stay safe, stay healthy. All of you fine listeners out there, stay safe, stay healthy, and we will see you all next week.
Yep. See you both next week.
Bye. Kotaku Split Screen is the official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Kirk Hamilton, Jason Schreier, and me, Maddie Myers. Kirk edits and mixes the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. You can find us on most popular podcast services, and we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at Kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.